intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, the Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
In your mind, does the world seem inverted? Backward, dissonant, dare to think out loud. You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded. Dare to think out loud. You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren. Dare to think out loud. You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history. Dare to think out loud. You have tuned in to the right show. Dare to think out loud. Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to Dare to Think Out Loud here on the 21st day of January in the year of 2022. And I am joined today, as usual, by my good friend from out there in western Arizona, Mr. Cal Robbins. Cal, how are you today, sir?
Doing good today, Mark. Thanks for asking. How are you doing?
Well, if I was any better, I'm sure I would be illegal in even more states than I am now.
Careful where you travel then.
Yes, well, I'm working on that, I promise you.
Good.
But, you know, we decided, well, you know, I decided, and of course you are always willing to go along with the direction in which, you know, I wish to take the program, and I certainly appreciate that. And yesterday on the Jim Ram show, I don't know if you were able to hear it, but old DW, Darrell Wayne, the retired commercial airline pilot, had a lot of really good things to say about you, Cal. Were you able to hear that?
I caught part of it. I've been trying to listen to it, and the audio breaks up every now and then on it. So he started saying something, and I kind of get embarrassed when I hear stuff like that.
Well,
I don't think of myself in that manner. I just come on here and just try to participate and go along with the show. And I truly enjoy the opportunity to be on this show with you.
Well,
it's a great learning experience.
Well, I certainly enjoy you being here, Cal. And I hope you don't mind if I take a moment or so to tell the people how fantastic it has been for me over the course of our, you know, knowing each other, talking with each other, and, you know, the things that we have done is to look at the progress you have made and, you know, how that you take, you know, the facts that are thrown out there and you even improve on the things that I offer. And I think that is just fantastic. I want to applaud you for that.
Well, thanks for the compliment, but isn't that how all human relationships are supposed to work? Mutual benefit to each other.
Well, you might want to keep that to yourself because Bubas doesn't want to hear it. I promise you.
They're in a win-all game, and win or loser. And I'm more of a win-win type. Look, you know, I look for wins for everybody. I celebrate when other people are successful, even if I'm not. I enjoy other people's success. I applaud that. I applaud other people's dreams and ambitions and achievements. I cherish it, so to speak. You know, I want the best, not just for myself, my family, but I want the best for everyone else. But I also understand that they kind of got to do it for themselves in a lot of ways. Yeah, you can help out emotionally, sometimes physically, mentally, all that stuff. But, you know, ultimately it's up to each individual, and I celebrate it when other people are successful.
Well, I appreciate that, Cal. And bridge that and to jump into the subject of today's program. 18 years ago this month, we were living in Tucson, Arizona, in the neighborhood of Tucson, Arizona, actually west of Tucson. And I was at the time heavily involved in coaching a special education basketball team for the Tohono O'odham Indian Reservation. And Tohono O'odham in their language means people of the desert. And my wife was the principal there at that school, and she had, she was a teacher then principal, and she had told me that they had a special ed basketball team. But they didn't have a coach. And I said, well, you know, I'll do what I can. Let's jump in here and let's get involved in this. And, you know, with a great deal of work and hard work, especially by the kids that I had from her school, we were able to go to Phoenix and participate in the state championship of special ed, and we were fortunate enough to win and become the champions that year. But also at that same time, I was writing an article, and I wrote this article, and the title of it was "The American Indian and the Great Emancipator." Well, I wanted to contrast what I felt was a great misunderstanding and a great injustice to American history. And so I wrote this article, and it was published in the Sierra Times, I believe on the 9th day of January in the year of 2003. And the article was almost immediately picked up by a website called UnitedNativeAmerica.com. Now, I always remember, and I was chastised many years prior to that by a very good man, an Oglala Sioux by the name of Tommy Rubidoux. And Tommy Rubidoux chastised me when we were actually serving together. And Tommy said, "Look, don't call me a Native American, because I am not a Native American. I am Oglala Sioux. And I don't like the phrase Native American, because you are a Native American. You were born here. That makes you a Native American. I was born here, makes me a Native American." He said, "I prefer to be called Oglala Sioux." And I said, "Okay, well, I understand that." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "Well, you know," I said, "do you understand where the word Indian came from?" And he said, "Oh, yes." He said, "I understand that very well." He said, Christopher Columbus was searching for, America, I suppose, but he landed in the West Indies, and so he met the people there, and so we became known as Indians. And I said, yeah, that's right. And he said, you know what? And I said, what's that? And he said, well, I'm just really glad that he didn't find turkey, because then we'd have been called turkeys instead of Indians. So he had a great sense of humor. But Cal, I sent you this article earlier, and I would like to read, first of all, my notes at the beginning of a republishing of this article, which I did this morning. And that was, as my authors know, this part three of my current anthology, an effort to expose the lie of the Lincoln myth and the cause of the war to prevent Southern independence, was written 18 years ago. I am most honored the people at United Native America's website have had this article prominently displayed on their website for the entirety of 18 years. As you read through this piece, please pay particular attention to the Declaration of Separation from the Union by the Cherokee Nation in 1861. While this declaration, written by Chief John Ross, is remarkably similar in many ways to the Declaration of Independence of 1776, it also contains Chief Ross's statement concerning his views of the war up to that date and the atrocities committed by the Union Army against the citizens of the South. To believe Lincoln was motivated to wage unconstitutional total war against the South and its civilian population, based on human rights issues such as bondage of the black race, while he simultaneously waged a war of extermination against the American Indian, is the height of hypocrisy and incredulity. But then there are a very large number of Americans who have assumed the mentality of Seinfeld's George Costanza when he stated, and I quote, "It ain't a lie if I believe it," unquote. So, Cal, before we venture into the particulars of the article, your comments, please, sir.
Well, you know, you sent that article to me earlier this week, and I read through it, and it fills in so much understanding of history. And we were talking before the show. I mean, you don't understand history if you leave out parts of history. You don't get a full understanding or picture of history. And, you know, none of this, I'm pretty sure, because, you know, I graduated in 1980, and none of this was taught to me anywhere near this in high school, in any civics course or anything. So I'm just grateful that, you know, you've done the research and put this article out there. And I hope we go through the whole thing today.
Well, I certainly hope to. And thanks for those comments, Cal. But I would like to thank the people at the website, UnitedNativeAmerica.com, because to prominently display my article for 18 years, man, that's a hell of an honor, and it really means a lot to me. But the article was actually published on January the 9th of 2003. And here I'll read the first paragraph, and then let's talk about it, Cal. And I said, perhaps the veneer of lies and historical distortions that surround Abraham Lincoln are beginning to crack. In the movie Gangs of New York, we finally have a historically correct representation of the real Abraham Lincoln and his policies. Heretofore, many socialistic intellectuals, politicians, and historians have whitewashed these policies in order to protect Lincoln's image because of their allegiance to the unconstitutional centralization of power he brought to our government. So, Cal, your thoughts on that first paragraph?
Well, I agree with it. I mean, the Gangs of New York, that's where I learned about the New York riots. I wasn't ever taught it. And so after seeing that, you know, it was like, wait, what was this riot thing? Is this true? So I looked it up, you know, and that's how I go down rabbit holes. I see things. It's like, okay, is this true? And so I go on a search to see if it's true or not. And this is one of the things that started my search for truth, you know, and my understanding of history, because not many people are aware that, you know, of, you know, and when you say Gangs of New York, you're talking about the riots and the fights. And when the federal government came in to draft the people of New York, how the people of New York actually rioted against the Union Army. Well, which is, they, you know, nobody teaches that. Nobody teaches that not everybody was on board with this war. Not everybody wanted to go off and, you know, especially after Lincoln made it, you know, supposedly made it about freeing the slaves. That actually was a deterrent, because most of the people weren't about wanting to free the slaves.
Well, Cal, how
you
many
can read people? Letters from Union Army men who said, well, I don't want to free the slaves. This isn't why we're fighting the war. I mean, even the Union side said it wasn't about it. The Confederate side said it wasn't about it. Yet the narrative today is it was about slavery. And it was the socialist part or wing of the Radical Republican Party that promoted that whole idea. So this whole, it's about slavery, is, it was the socialist trying to take advantage of the war. So it's a socialist idea.
Well, absolutely. How many people, Cal, are familiar or even have a knowledge of the fact that the city of New York petition to secede from the Union?
Oh yeah, the mayor of New York wanted to secede from the Union. The governor of New York, he was opposed to it. He was opposed to the war. He was like, wait a minute, the North is oppressing the South. I mean, he could look at the picture and go, well, yeah, there is injustice. I can't blame these guys for wanting to leave. And you know, there were calmer heads at the time, but, you know, the Lincoln regime won out in the end, the radical Republicans. I know we all blame it completely on Lincoln, and he was a driving force behind it, but you got to remember there were a lot of people who also supported Lincoln in his ways. Otherwise, he couldn't do what he did.
Well, that is true, Cal, but the real truth is that the majority of his cabinet, the radical Republicans, didn't care for Lincoln at all, and they referred to Lincoln in letters and notes amongst themselves, and they called him the baboon down the hall. And, you know, we
are. So what you're saying, the president was a puppet? King Abe himself was a puppet?
He was absolutely a puppet of the Republican Party, which was a Marxist dominated party. And yes, he was the puppet.
Yes, he was their figurehead.
And when
kind of like how Washington was a puppet and a figurehead at the Constitutional Convention to be used by the Federalists, kind of like that.
Yeah, and when Lincoln ceased to be useful, what happened to him?
He got Arkansas-ed.
Yeah, that is true. Well, let's jump to the second paragraph. The false sainthood and adulation afforded Lincoln has its basis in the incorrect assumption he fought the war to free an enslaved people. To believe this propaganda, one must ignore most everything Lincoln said about the black race and his continued efforts at colonization. Lincoln's treatment of the American Indian has been very much ignored by supporters of the Lincoln Leviathan and his unconstitutional war. And now I'll jump to the next paragraph and then we'll discuss it. One would find it hard to refute Abraham Lincoln's political idol was Henry Clay. Lincoln would say of Clay, and I quote, "During my whole political life, I have loved and revered Henry Clay as a teacher and a leader." Lincoln, unquote. Lincoln delivered the eulogy at the funeral for Henry Clay. When elected president, Lincoln set about implementing Henry Clay's political philosophies. And I'll jump to the next paragraph, and then we'll discuss that. Now, pardon me, I jumped to another one. Throughout Clay's political life, he was a strong believer in national socialism and a complete racist in all references to the American Indian. As Secretary of State, Henry Clay would declare, and I quote again, "The Indian's disappearance from the human family will be no great loss to the world. I do not think them as a race worth preserving," unquote. Cal?
My first question is, okay, who is Henry Clay?
Oh,
I made a mental note to go find out who Henry Clay was and have neglected to find out about that. So hopefully you have some insight on who this idol of Lincoln's was.
Well, he was the originator of what we call today social welfare. He wanted the federal government to pay for everything that was to be built and everything that was to be done. He thought that, you know, and Lincoln stood by that in his term in Congress. He stood by it very much. He wanted this system of money being paid to contractors to build buildings and railroads and all this other stuff. And Lincoln certainly would follow this later in his career with the railroad. The subsidies that the federal government gave to private enterprise if they were politically well connected. And then let's look at Henry Clay, because this happened when he was Secretary of State. This mentality of Clay led to the forced walk of all Cherokees from the mountains of Tennessee, North Carolina, and Georgia to Oklahoma during the winter of 1838. Over 20,000 Cherokees were dragged from their homes, which were then plundered and burned. They were force-marched, most of them barefooted, all the way to Oklahoma during the dead of winter, with the sky for their blanket and the earth for their pillow. That's their quote. Over 4,000 Cherokees died on this march, and it became known as the Trail of Tears. And there is a, in Cherokee, North Carolina, there is a pageant every year unto these hills, which is dedicated to that march. And that Trail of Tears, and I've followed it on several occasions, especially through the state of Arkansas. And that Trail of Tears, where 4,000 Cherokees died on a forced march, which was accompanied by the Union Army. Of course, it was the only army at that time. And many times the women were raped on this trip to Oklahoma. But let's look at this, Cal. Similar atrocities occurred all through the Lincoln administration. In 1862, the Santee Sioux of Minnesota grew tired of waiting for the $1.4 million they had been promised for the sale of 24 million acres of land to the federal government in 1851. Their appeals to President Lincoln fell on deaf ears. What made this even more egregious to the Sioux was the invasion of this yet unpaid-for land by thousands of white settlers. Then, with a very poor crop in August of 1862, many of the Indians were hungry and facing starvation for an upcoming winter. When Lincoln outright refused to pay the owed money, remember he had a war to finance, who was going to pay Indians for their land, the Indians revolted. Lincoln assigned General John Pope to quell the uprising, and he announced at the beginning of his campaign, and I quote, people, listen to this very carefully, "It is my purpose to utterly exterminate the Sioux. They are to be treated as maniacs or wild beasts, and by no means as people with whom treaties or compromise can be made." Lincoln did not ever challenge this statement. Cal?
It just kind of goes to show the mental ideology they had towards the Native Americans at that time. I mean, to see them not even as humans. So yeah, there they are, humans, yet yeah, we're fighting a war to free the black race, who they also didn't see as humans. They saw them as property. At least they saw the black African slave as property. They saw the American Indian as even less than that. I mean, a slave has worth. The Indian had, in their mind, absolutely no worth. They were
the Indians were just in the way, right, Cal?
Yeah. That's even a lower opinion of the American Indian than the people had of a black slave. Because, like I say, even if you're a slave owner, that slave is still an asset towards you. I mean, that's not to condone slavery. That's just to say that was their opinion of it. And so, you know, the abuse of slaves didn't happen as much as they said, because that would be like abusing your horse. And, you know, it did happen. Some people were like that. But, yeah, the whole narrative is so wrong. And then when you look at this, and it's like they're looking at the Indians as not even human.
Well,
not even,
you know,
property.
Exactly. And what was really, you know, one of the interesting anecdotes here, and I'll throw this in with my research into history, was that John Pope, who Lincoln had just assigned to quell the uprising, he had just lost a battle as a general commanding forces for the Union in the war to prevent Southern independence. And he had gotten his ass handed to him by one Stonewall Jackson at the Battle of Second Manassas, or Second Bull Run. Now, there's a story that pops into my head, being a lover of and a vociferous appetite for history of the war to prevent Southern independence. I remember that when John Pope was given a command of the Union Army, and he wrote back to Abraham Lincoln and said, "Never fear, Mr. President, my headquarters will always be in the saddle." To which Stonewall Jackson responded in the Southern press, "General Pope has his headquarters where his hindquarters ought to be." I'm sorry, I had to throw that in there, because that is one of the, you know, it may be a trivial comment to most people, but that's one of the ones that I really enjoyed from my study of the history of the war to prevent Southern independence. But the Indians, the Santee Sioux, were quickly defeated in October of 1862, and General Pope herded all of the Indians, men, women, and children, into forts where military trials were immediately convened. What happened to a trial by jury of your peers? I bet there were no Indians on the jury. Anyway, none of the Indians.
Mike,
sir,
Mike,
go ahead.
These Indians they dragged to trial weren't even the Indians. They were Santee Sioux. But they weren't even the Indians involved in the raids on the white settlers.
What damn difference
all of
those, that made?
All of those Indians, they had fled. They'd gone up, moved up into Canada, into Quebec. I mean, they weren't the ones being tried. The ones that actually, you know, went to war with the United States, and it was an act of war by the Indians. So why are we having civil trials for war crimes? They weren't even the ones. They just happened to be Santee Sioux.
Well, that made them guilty. Cal, what's wrong
by
with you? Don't you understand this government?
Yeah, by association. Yeah, well,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's the only good Indian is a dead Indian analogy. Which,
well, that,
you know,
that came directly from the lips of William Tecumseh Sherman.
Sherman, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, none of the Indians who were tried were given any semblance of a defense. Each of their trials lasted approximately 10 minutes. All adult males were found guilty of murder and sentenced to death, with the only evidence against them being that they might have been present during a war which they themselves had declared against the U.S. government. The authorities in Minnesota asked Lincoln to order the immediate execution of all 303 males found guilty. Lincoln was concerned with how this would play with the Europeans, the British and the French, whom he was afraid were about to enter the war on the side of the South. So Lincoln offered a compromise to the politicians of Minnesota. They would pare the list of those to be hanged down to 39. In return, Lincoln promised to kill or remove every Indian from the state and provide Minnesota with $2 million in federal funds. But it's important that we remember he only owed the Sioux $1.4 million for the land. Cal?
Just your more thoughts? Shining, just more shining hypocrisy of the federal government.
And it hadn't gotten any better, has it?
No. No. It's just continued down the same path.
So on December the 26th, the day after Christmas in 1862, Abraham Lincoln, the great emancipator, ordered the largest mass execution in American history. For the guilt of those to be executed was entirely in doubt. Regardless of how Lincoln's defenders seek to play this, it was nothing more than murder, pardon me, to obtain the land of the Santee Sioux and to appease Lincoln's political cronies in Minnesota. Lincoln's Western armies, using the tactics of murder, rape, burning, and pillaging, simultaneously being used against Southern noncombatants by the Eastern armies, turned their attention to the Navajo tribe. Cal, your thoughts?
Well, one of the things that happened was the governor of Minnesota, I mean, we're talking 1863 when this happened. There was an election for 1864 for the president. And Lincoln suffered in the Electoral College in Minnesota because he pared down how many of those Indians were to be hung. And the governor told him, you would have had more votes in Minnesota if you would have executed more Indians. And Lincoln replied, he couldn't afford to execute more of the Indians. And that's because he couldn't afford to on how it would play out with the Europeans. So he was playing politics. So he played politics with the lives of those, you know, the 30, actually it was 38 Indians. One more got a pardon for some reason. And, but for paring it down, and, you know, he did it for political reasons, not for justice. Like I said, I mean, the Sioux Indians, they declared war. So this is like, okay, now this is, you know, under the rules of war. So, well, the army, which was the band that escaped into Canada. So let's go capture all the civilians and try them for the war. Which, you know, this is, you know, the men, women, and children. Well, all the men who weren't participating in the fighting, well, they were still there. Let's capture them and punish them politically. This wasn't about justice. This was about politics and revenge. So it wasn't about justice.
Well, Cal, the next
part. Of course, Lincoln administration never was.
No, it was never about justice. It was about domination and collecting taxes and revenue. That's what the war was about. But Marxists, indubitably, throughout history, will find a moral high ground that they can stand on. And we're seeing it right now in our own history right now, how morally superior they are to everyone else, especially when it comes to taking the vaccine or, you know, all of the other stuff. It's a moral superior viewpoint. And it's traditional with the Marxist, always has been. And so here is one of the things, Cal, I was most fortunate. Pardon me. was just talking to my son a couple of days ago, and we were reminiscing about our days where we lived on the Navajo Indian Reservation. And my son was talking about that is where he really learned what it was like to be a minority. Because at Shiprock High School in northern New Mexico, our son Chris was the only Anglo kid in his high school. Not just his class, the entire school. And so he was commenting about what a wonderful lesson he learned during that time. And he was talking about all of the friends that he remembered after that. And he was, and I told him at the time, he did not understand, I don't think at the time, he does now, but how important it was that on the Shiprock High School Chieftain football team, he was picked by his fellow football players to be one of the captains of the team. And when he came home and he told us about that, we were living in the wonderful town of Sanaste, New Mexico, on the Navajo Reservation. And he came home and he said, Dad, I was selected to be one of the captains of the football team. And I said, Son, right now, you may not understand what a fantastic achievement that is for your team members who were all Navajo to elect you one of the captains. I said, that is fantastic. Today he realizes how fantastic that was for him. And one of his favorite sayings is now he tells people, hey, I played in the NFL. And they said, really? And he says, yes, the Navajo Football League. So our experiences there were fantastic, Cal. We spent a lot of time with the Navajos. We got to know them. We went to several different events. We were invited, and I believe it was 1990, to come to one of the people's homes for Thanksgiving. Think of the irony of this. We were invited to come and have Thanksgiving dinner with them. And about, I would say, you know, about an hour into the people arriving, and there ended up being over 75 members of the extended Navajo Yazi family where we were invited. And my son comes walking up to me. He's in high school at the time, and he comes walking up to me and he says, Dad, have you noticed we're the only white people here? And I said, yeah, son. So what difference does that make? And he said, well, Dad, I just thought it was unusual because there's other Anglo teachers and they weren't invited. And I said, well, son, take that as a star in your crown. Because if these people cared enough to invite us to come. And it was a very funny time, Cal, because one of my friends, Daniel Yazzie, walks up to me and he says, okay, he says, well, what do you think about our get-together here? And I'm looking around at about approximately 75, 80 Navajos, with everybody brought a dish and there's food everywhere and everybody's talking. And we ate in a hogan. We went in and were served in a hogan, which is a traditional Navajo structure. And we come out and we're sitting and we're talking. And my friend Daniel says, well, what do you think about this event? And I said, Daniel, you want to know the truth? And he said, sure. And I said, now I know how Custer felt. And he had to tell the entire, he just called attention to the entire crowd. And then he spoke in Navajo and told them what I had just said. And the entire place broke out in laughter. It was incredible. But we did cattle drives with these people. We did fence building, corral building. We spent a wonderful time with these Navajo people. And it was certainly an experience which I will never regret to get to know these people and get to know them on their level, not ours, but to know them on their level. So, Cal, any comments on that?
Well, I would just say, Mike, you got to know them on a human level. It's not our level, their level. You got to know them on a human level. Because deep down, we're all human. We're all born with the same unalienable rights. You know, we come from different backgrounds, different traditions. But bottom line is we're, you know, all part of this brotherhood of men. And, you know, that is an honor to be accepted in amongst them into their society in the way they conduct their lives and how you integrated and were accepted into that. But that's just showing how humanity and how liberty actually work. That's just an example of how things should be.
Well, it was such a pleasurable time. One of the things we truly enjoyed was the cattle drives. And that was, they have two cattle drives a year. In the spring, they round up all of their cattle in the low country and they drive them into the Chuska Mountains and leave them up there where there's water and grass and what have you for the summer. And then about Labor Day, they go up, round them all up, and head them back down to the flatlands for the winter time. And we participated in that for years. Even when we moved to Tucson and my wife was employed with the Tohono O'odham tribe, as I mentioned before, even then we would drive back on those holiday weekends on the Memorial Day to take the cattle up the mountain and on Labor Day to bring the cattle down the mountain. And we spent a lot of time with these people in their environment. But one year, a friend of mine from Oklahoma City, I had talked with him about what I was doing. And he said, wow, he said, do you think I could come along? And I said, yeah, if you're willing to work, you can come along. And he said, well, I'll fly into Albuquerque if you'll pick me up. He said, I would love to do this. He said, just for the experience. So I picked him up, brought him up to Sanasti, and he started out the cattle drive with us. Well, he lasted in a horse one day. And then he hadn't been riding as much, and a whole day in the saddle is a little bit tough for people who haven't done it. So it's about 10 to 12 hours a day in the saddle. And so my friends, he says, well, the next morning, I said, how are you feeling? He said, I'm not doing well. I can barely walk. And I said, well, guess what? You get to ride with the women. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, if you can't work, you ride with the women. The women move ahead of the men in the cattle drive. They move by truck, and they take the roads. They don't take the way that we take the cattle. They take the roads, which are all dirt roads. And they take the roads and they get ahead of us where they think we'll be at lunchtime or where we will be at lunchtime, and they prepare lunch. And then they get to where we'll be at dinner time and they prepare dinner, supper, whatever you want to call it. And I said, because you can't ride the horses, you're going to have to go with the women. And I said, he said, okay, all right. But after the cattle drive, I'll never forget Rick coming up to me and saying, you know what? Man, this was really, really something. He said, I'll cherish this the rest of my life. And he said, you know, one of the things I noticed was how peaceful and how quiet and how, you know, except for, you know, the cattle mooing and the people yelling and, you know, at the cattle and all the other stuff. He said, the thing I will remember is I heard a plane fly over and I got angry at the sound. He said, because it broke the spell of being here. And so, Cal, those are some of my favorite memories. And but I was talking about the Navajo because one of the things that even the Navajo did not know, and I brought it up to several of them who were school teachers with my wife, and they're instead of the, you know, the Trail of Tears by the Cherokee, the Navajos have what they call the Long Walk. And that's when they were all herded up by the Union Army under Abraham Lincoln and forced to march to Bosco Redondo. But to proceed with my article, in 1863 to 64, General Carleton and his subordinate, Colonel Kit Carson, invaded the Navajo land under Lincoln's directions, especially those concentrated in the Canyon de Chelly area. Crops were burned, innocents were murdered, women were raped, and general chaos was rained upon these noble people simply because, like the Santee Sioux, they demanded from Lincoln what they had been promised, their land and to be left alone. General Carleton, believing there was gold to be found in the area, stated, and I quote, "Listen to this, people. This is your wonderful U.S. government who was fighting a war to free the slaves." Bullshit. But here's what Carleton said. "This war," directing it to the Navajos, "this war will be pursued against you if it takes years until you cease to exist or you move." There was absolutely no protest of this policy from Abraham Lincoln, who was the commander in chief and had ordered the expulsion of the Navajo from their native lands. The Navajo were forced to march over 300 miles to Bosque Redondo in eastern New Mexico. Over 200 Navajos died on this march, and eventually over 2,000 Navajos perished before a treaty was signed in 1868. While at Bosque Redondo, the Navajos suffered the vilest conditions, bitter water, no firewood, and impossible growing conditions for crops. The soldiers and the Mexican guards subjected the women to rape and humiliating treatment. Children born at this concentration camp were lucky to survive their first few months of life. So, comments, Cal?
Well, first thing, Mexican guards. So that would be Mexican mercenaries hired by the Union Army?
Of course.
And this was done by Lincoln. There was no mark of reprisal or letters of mark of reprisal to hire these mercenaries?
Nope.
I'm guessing. So, okay. Just trying, you know, just filling in little holes on this. Yeah.
Go ahead.
The Navajos were unaware that it was Lincoln who did this. Yeah. In talking with you another time, you've been to, like, the schools have, you know, prominently displayed Lincoln because of this mythology about Lincoln, because of this adulation of Lincoln. They were unaware of what Lincoln caused to their ancestors or did to their ancestors.
Well, Cal, I remember walking into Red Valley School, which is in Arizona, right across the New Mexico border on the Navajo Reservation. I remember walking in there because I went in, my wife was principal of the school. I walked in to participate in the tribute to the Long Walk. And this is what we have just talked about. And they had the celebration in the school for this remembrance. I don't think it was a celebration, but the remembrance. And I walked into a classroom and I heard the presentations by several of the Navajo teachers, including the principal, God rest his soul, Mike Luther. And he gave the presentation. He was the former principal before my wife, but he gave the presentation. And they talked about how their people were herded up, all of the things, the atrocities that were committed against them. And when the speakers were finally completed, I asked one of the teachers that I knew there, I asked him, I said, "Are you familiar by any chance with the President of the United States who ordered this Long Walk that you commemorate every year?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Well, turn around and look behind you. His picture's on the wall." And he said, "Lincoln?" And I said, "Yes, Ray, Lincoln. Lincoln ordered this march." I said, "What year was it?" And he said, late 1863, early 1864. I said, "Well, who was President of the United States? Did you think General Carleton and Kit Carson acted on their own?" And he was stunned. And the other people, the other Navajos in the classroom were stunned. Because they had never been taught in their government schools, Bureau of Indian Affairs, or as I was told by several Navajos, that BIA meant boss Indians around, that they were never taught that Lincoln was the one who ordered their long walk. And yet in their schools, they praised Lincoln for freeing the people of color. That, to me, I was just absolutely amazed at that, Cal. And it was the fact that they didn't know and they hadn't been taught. And these teachers had graduated and had teacher's degrees. And I talked with several of them that day at lunchtime. We sat at a table together and they said, "Why were we not taught this?" And I said, "Where'd you go to school?" "Oh, I went to University of Arizona. I went to, the college up in Durango, Colorado. I went here. I went there." And I said, "What was your field of study?" And they said, "Well, most often it was Native American studies." And I said, "And you weren't taught about Lincoln?" "Oh, no, all we were taught about Lincoln was he freed the slaves." People, you want to know why your children are ignorant today? You pay taxes so the government can make them ignorant? Thoughts, Cal?
Well, what was the reason General Carleton, they decided to move the Indians? Was it because they thought there might be gold where they were at?
Yes. And
didn't that happen all over the Western United States?
Well, not only that, Cal, but they were in a fertile part of the area out there, which is hard to find in the high desert plateau. Fertile areas are hard to find. And in the Canyon de Chelly area, they had peach orchards. They were growing sheep. They were doing a lot of things. And, of course, the word got out. But today, just to show you, if you go into the Navajo land today, not so much as it was when I was there earlier, but Navajos and, the Utes don't like each other. And one of the reasons that the Navajos are so angry at the Utes is because it was Kit Carson who hired Ute scouts to lead them into the Navajo Nation to show them where Canyon de Chelly was. So they still have an animosity against another tribe of American Indians, the Ute Mountain Utes especially. They're angry at them, but they didn't know that Lincoln was behind the whole thing. So perversion of history works, Cal.
But you look around at Ubis Americanus and, yeah, you'd have to agree with that. Perversion of history works.
Right. Well, the one thing I want to get into in our second hour is that, and I'll read the next paragraph of my article, as our founding fathers did in our Declaration of Independence from the British, the Cherokee Nation listed its grievances with the Union when they declared their unification with the Confederate States of America on October the 28th of 1861. These brave people, the Cherokee tribe, and many other southeastern Native American or American Indian tribes, had already observed the atrocities of Lincoln's war criminals and saw through any so-called war for liberation of people of color. So, Cal, we've got like, 3-4 minutes. You want to comment on that, and we'll go into the Cherokee Nation Declaration of Independence from the Union. And I'll bet you folks out there haven't ever read this one before. Have you, Cal?
I'd never read it until you posted it and shared it. So, yeah, as of up until earlier this week, no, I'd never read it. And it's just... Well, I had a thought on that. The Trail of Tears happened before. When did the Trail of Tears happen?
I think it was 1838.
That was under the Jackson regime?
Yes.
Andrew Jackson?
Yeah, Jackson ordered that.
So the Cherokee had already personally witnessed the atrocities of the United States government.
Yes.
On their own people and how. So... them wanting to declare unification with the Confederate States would make sense. One, because they're already in Oklahoma now, because that's where they got moved to, I'm guessing. And maybe they thought their fortunes might be a little better not being with this government that's already forced us out of our land and, you know, killed so many of our ancestors. So I can see why they would align with the Confederate States.
Well, Cal, that is a very astute observation when we look at that fact. And we stop and think about they had already been forced relocated. But let me ask you a question. With your knowledge of the war to prevent Southern independence, how many generals did Lincoln have who were American Indians?
None that I'm aware of.
Well, wait a minute. Weren't they people of color?
Well, but you got to remember, they're Indians. They're even less than slaves, according to some.
Well, how many generals did the Confederate Army have who were American Indians?
They had three or four, didn't they?
Well, actually, they only had one general.
Oh, okay. But they
had the general that they had was a Cherokee. His name was Stanwaddy. And believe it or not, he was one of the last people in the Confederacy to surrender, and he surrendered on the banks of the Arkansas River just to the Oklahoma side of Fort Smith, Arkansas. And this was long after Lee had surrendered at Appomattox, several months later. So the Confederacy had a general who was a man of color. But the Union didn't have any. Do you see anything wrong here, Cal?
Yeah, the whole narrative. Everything we were taught is wrong. I mean, the Cherokee are looking at the United States forcibly moving into the southern states and telling them what to do, which really wasn't any difference in the United States moving in and forcing the Cherokee to move to Oklahoma. It was just a different kind of authoritarianism. So you're just watching the government do what the government does. And it's all over land. They moved people for control over land because, well, they thought there was gold in this land, or they needed to have settlers in this land. So,
well, I think that's the music, Cal. We'll be back on the flip side, folks, with Dare to Think Out Loud. Come back and join us, please.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Interested in the paranormal, murder mystery, real natural law? You enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crip Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio, Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's hybrid thinking. Welcome to the Crypt.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for free association. when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
That's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener-supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Well, welcome back, everyone, to Dare to Think Out Loud here on the 21st day of January in the year of 2022. And again, I am joined by my good friend and co-host here, Cal Robbins, from out in western Arizona. And today we are discussing the American Indian and the Great Emancipator. You know, the man who has a huge monument on the banks of the Potomac River. The president who probably violated the Constitution more than any president in American history. I mean, who else? What other president has ever arrested a complete state legislature and put them in prison without due process? But, you know, he's the great emancipator. Cal, any thoughts before we jump into what John Ross had to say for the Cherokee Indians?
Well, you say, you know, Lincoln is the great emancipator because he issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Who issues proclamations? Kings? Dictators?
Well, according...
Isn't that who issues proclamations? The king?
Yes, and mandates.
This, and mandates?
And mandates.
So it is fitting that the monument to Lincoln has him sitting on a throne, isn't it? In D.C. It is fitting that, you know, most monuments, you know, it shows someone on horseback, someone standing, but King Abe, he's sitting on his throne.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to point that out. It's like, that would be the Emancipation Proclamation. That would be like the ultimate executive order, wouldn't it?
Well, you know, Cal,
This is, you know, so it is written, so let it be written, so let it be done from, what was that, Moses, the movie? Ramsey saying that? it's exactly what it was. I mean, Ramsey was ultimately in control of the Egyptian people. I guess King Abe was ultimately considered himself in control of the American people, except for those who disagreed with him, who he had imprisoned or arrested.
Well, exactly. And I can remember the mid to late 80s when I lived on Wilson Boulevard in Alexandria, Virginia, and I was working with the American Foundation for Accountability of Prisoners of War and Missing in Action. I can remember sometimes walking across the Teddy Roosevelt Bridge, the TRB, as we called it back then. I can remember late at night when I couldn't sleep, walking across the bridge, walking over directly as you come across the bridge, you're facing the Lincoln Memorial, and to walk around and go up the steps. Weren't many people there at 2 or 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. Walking up the steps and walking up and standing before the throne of King Abe. Of course, I won't tell you what I said or did while I was there, but that's beside the point. I think the statute of limitations might cover me for that, but I might be included in the January 6th raid if I say too much. You know, there is a retro effect there. They can get you if you hate the government. I don't care how many years later it was. But I remember that. I would also take that time to walk down to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which is right down from the Lincoln Memorial, and to go down and spend a little time at panel 27 East and spend a little time looking at the names of some old friends from 1967. But that will suffice to be covered at another date. Let's get back to the Cherokee Indians and when they declared their independence from the United States government on October the 28th of 1861. Let's read what John Ross, chief of the Cherokee tribe, let's read what he said and see if we can find any similarities there with the American Declaration of Independence of 1776. And I quote, "When circumstances beyond their control compel one people to sever the ties which have long existed between them and another state or confederacy, and to contract new alliances and establish new relations for the security of their rights and liberties, it is fit that they should publicly declare the reasons by which their action is justified." The Cherokee people had its origins in the South. Its institutions are similar to those of the Southern states, and their interests identical to theirs. Long since it accepted the protection of the United States of America, contracted with them treaties of alliance and friendship, and allowed themselves to be, to a great extent, governed by their laws. In peace and war, they have been faithful to their engagements with the United States. With much hardship and injustice to complain of, they resorted to no other means than solicitation and argument to obtain redress. Loyal and obedient to the laws and the stipulations of the treaties, they served under the flag of the United States, shared the common dangers, and were entitled to a share in the common glory, to gain which their blood was freely shed on the battlefield. When the dissensions between the Southern and Northern states culminated in a separation of state after state from the Union, they, meaning the Cherokees, watched the progress of events with anxiety and consternation. While their institutions and the contiguity of their territory to the states of Arkansas, Texas, and Missouri made the cause of the seceding states necessarily their own cause, their treaties had been made with the United States, and they felt the utmost reluctance, even in appearance, to violate their engagements or to set at naught the obligations of good faith. But providence rules the destinies of nations, and events by inexorably necessity overrule human relations. Resolutions, I'm sorry. The number of the Confederate states increased to 11, and their government is firmly established and consolidated. Maintaining in the field an army of 200,000 men, the war became for them but a succession of victories. Disclaiming any intention to invade the northern states, they sought only to repel invaders from their own soil and to secure the right of governing themselves. They claimed only the privilege asserted by the Declaration of American Independence, and on which the right of the northern states themselves to self-government is formed, of altering their form of government when it became no longer tolerable, and establishing new forms for the security of their liberties. Throughout the Confederate States, we saw this great revolution effected without violence or suspension of the laws or the closing of the courts. The military power was nowhere placed above civil authorities. None were seized and imprisoned at the mandate of arbitrary power. All division among the people disappeared, and the determination became unanimous that there should never again be any union with the northern states. Almost as one man, all who were able to bear arms rushed to the defense of an invaded country. And nowhere has it been found necessary to compel men to serve or to enlist mercenaries by the offer of extraordinary bounties. Pardon me. But in the northern states, the Cherokee people saw with alarm a violated constitution, all civil liberties put in peril, and all rules of civilized warfare and the dictates of common humanity and decency unhesitatingly disregarded. In states which still adhered to the Union, a military despotism had displaced the civil power, and the laws became silent amid arms. Free speech and almost free thought became a crime. The right of the writ of habeas corpus, guaranteed by the Constitution, disappeared at the nod of a Secretary of State or a general of the lowest grade. The mandate of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court was at naught by the military power, and this outrage on common right approved by a president sworn to support the Constitution. War on the largest scale was waged, and the immense bodies of troops called into the field in the absence of any law warranting it under the pretense of suppressing unlawful combination of men. The humanities of war, which even barbarians respect, were no longer thought worthy to be observed. Foreign mercenaries and the scum of the cities and the inmates of prisons were enlisted and organized into brigades and sent into southern states to aid in subjugating a people struggling for freedom, to burn, to plunder, and to commit the basest of outrages on the women. Whilst the heels of the armed tyranny trod upon the necks of Maryland and Missouri, and men of the highest character and position were incarcerated upon suspicion and without process of law, in jails, in forts, and prison ships. And even women were imprisoned by the arbitrary order of a president and cabinet ministers. While the press ceased to be free, and the publication of newspapers was suspended, and their issues seized and destroyed, the officers and men taken prisoners in the battles were allowed to remain in captivity by the refusal of the government to consent to an exchange of prisoners, as they had left their dead on more than one field of battle, that had witnessed their defeat, to be buried and their wounded to be cared for by Southern hands. Unquote. Comments, Cal?
Well, you'll notice there are a lot of similarities to the actual Declaration of Independence. It's, like I say, it's a, you know, the second time I've read it, we're reading through it again with you. The first time was just a few days ago. And there's some profound comments in there. I mean, people are, you know, the Cherokee people are trying to choose freedom over subjection. And that's what they see coming from the Union, from the current United States. And this was in October, the end of October. Where was this at? The date there's October 1861. So the war hasn't even been going on that long, and these atrocities are happening.
Well, they happened from the very beginning, Cal.
Well, yeah, they did. They progressively got worse. Yeah, October 28th, 1861. And you know, the Cherokee, according to this, they're feeling that, you know, they've had this long affiliation with the United States, even though they've been subjected and moved to Oklahoma, but they were still trying to get along. They were still trying to do their thing, but you know, there were too much contentions going on. The southern states seceded, and I guess they were kind of in the position where, you know, we've got to make a stand one way or the other. And they made a stand not to go with the tyranny that was coming from the Union. A tyranny that continues today that people embrace. Which is,
well,
I mean,
well,
it mentions foreign mercenary in the scum of cities. It's like, well, yeah, they hired, you know, Mexicans to guard over the Navajo. Those were mercenaries. I mean, this is a government that will do anything and hire anybody and throw anything at you to enforce its will upon the people whenever it should decide to do so. You made a point earlier, Jennifer, in the chat room, you know, you said that, you know, Lincoln was violating the Constitution, and Jennifer says, well, Lincoln was actually exercising the Constitution to its fullest extent. And I got to agree with that. Lincoln was taking the Constitution to its ultimate conclusion. He, through his declaration of war and what he did, exposed the powers delegated through the Constitution to this government. It just goes to show, if the government, this government under this Constitution, if it feels that it's necessary and proper to do something in order to secure the general welfare of the United States. Notice it doesn't say secure the liberty of the people, secure the welfare of the general welfare of the United States, meaning the United States as a corporation, that any power is available. So actually Lincoln, he wasn't the greatest violator of the Constitution. He was the greatest exerciser of the Constitution. This is what the Constitution, if you keep clinging to it, this is what it will do. Lincoln has proved it. If you keep saying we need to get back to Constitution, or the Constitution this, people get all upset about, you know, saying, well, the government's violating the Constitution. And I'm like, you don't have anything to say about the government violating your rights. You're upset about it violating words on parchment. Where's your priorities, people? And I just wanted to make that point. It's like, yeah, and the Cherokee people chose freedom.
Imagine
they chose
that.
To try to be free. That's all they wanted to be. And when it comes down to it, a lot of people, if they get out of this political left-right paradigm, most people, that's all you want to do. You just want to live your life. You want to be free. But you can't do that if somebody's trying to impose their will upon you. And you can't do that if you're trying to impose through politics or government your will upon others. I mean, Mike, you went and you lived with the Navajo on their, in their area under their terms and assimilated into them to where they accepted you as one of them. And that's how it should be anywhere you go. I mean, these people, they had, you know, they settled on this land, or, well, they got moved to it by the time when you got there, they'd been moved to that land. But they'd adapted, and you settled in with them. You didn't try to change them. You didn't try to tell them how they should be. You settled in with them and went along with them. And that's how liberty works.
Well,
I don't understand how people don't get it. I don't understand how I'm supposed to be able to tell people in New York how to live, and people in New York are supposed to be able to tell me how to live. Yet I'm supposed to support this country that says me and New York got to be the same. I don't get it. There shouldn't be that concentration of power. It should continually break down into smaller and smaller divisions. The proper growth of rightful liberty, there'd be a bazillion different little governments all over the place. And we just get along because, oh yeah, there's a brotherhood of men. We're all equal in our rights. I don't want to win or lose and destroy you. I would compete with you over in a competition over, say, a sale or something, but I wouldn't want to destroy you over it because that's just not how it should be. It's not a win-loss thing. It should be a win-win. And that's what people need to look for. Right now, everybody's looking for, you know, we win, you lose. And that's all that matters is the win. Doesn't matter what you got to do to get the win. The means has to justify the end, and the end has to be a win. So people are willing to accept almost any kind of tyranny in order to get that win. And that's by design. And people keep falling for it. Sorry, I kind of went off on my own tangent there.
Hey, don't apologize. I enjoy it when you get going there, buddy. I'm you're not going to hear any complaints from me. But
I feel like I'm off in the weeds out there, you know, talking. You know, some people might see it as word salad, but you know, yeah, it makes sense to me, and I have a hard time articulating it so that others might understand it. And it goes back to the revolution has got to be within the hearts and minds of the individual. Part of that is your minds and how you view things. And so things like this Declaration of Independence from the Cherokee people. I mean, the stereotype of an Indian, you wouldn't expect something this articulate to come out of the savage, the noble savage, would you? Yet there it is. This could have been written by, you know, this is on par with anything Jefferson could have wrote.
And this was written by the president of the Cherokee tribe, or the chairman, whatever you wanted to call him. Although,
however they called themselves, you know, however they had their hierarchy, but it's articulated, it's to the point, it's a great piece, and it serves as a declaration, another declaratory charter of the rights of man. You know, it's about exercising rightful liberty, securing and exercising rightful liberty. And if you need to alter your form of government, if you need to have government, that's part of it. That's part of that evolutionary process, people.
Well, Cal, I'm going to repeat a story here that happened when we were at a gathering on the Navajo. And it meant so much to me that the matriarch of the family, and I just put her picture in the our chat room on Rebel Madman. For a chance for people to see the matriarch and the patriarch of the family that I became so close with. But the matriarch of that family, we went back there after we had gone to Tucson, and we were with the Tohono O'odham tribe for a while, and we would come back for the cattle drives. And one of the things I remember is she had in her kitchen on the wall, and she would use, you know, thumbtacks or what have you, to put up pictures of her grandchildren. So when we went there after we'd been in Tucson for a couple of years and went there for a fall cattle drive, we went into the kitchen and I was humbled beyond words of the fact that she had the pictures of our two children up there with her grandchildren. And you know, most of you probably won't understand how important, how exactly special that made me feel. Because the matriarch of the family refused to speak English. She totally understood what you were saying, but she would not speak English. She was old school. And she was not about to say a word in English anywhere. But I really, really cared for that lady and her husband. Her husband passed away many years before she did. But I didn't get to know him as well as I got to know her. But one of the things I will remember, Cal, and let me bring this up, and some people might object to this for the way it was said, but I didn't take it that way. But we were there at a large group, and there were probably 110, 120 Navajo extended family people at a gathering. And, they were, they had mutton stew and fry bread and all of the traditional dishes. But I was standing with my friend Daniel Yazzie, and I said, and I looked around, and I said, "Daniel, I have a question." And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, I look around here, and I know that there's other Anglo teachers at the school." And Daniel was a school bus driver at the school, and his sister Bessie was the cook, and his brother-in-law Raymond Lansing was the custodian. And I said, "There are other Anglo teachers at the school, Daniel, but did you not invite any of them?" And he said, "No, we didn't." And I said, "Well, why did you invite our family?" And he said, when you got here, you didn't tell us that the way we were doing things was wrong. You didn't pretend to be superior to us. And you know what? You didn't tell us that you were here to save our heathen souls." He said, "And because you volunteered to help us with the cattle, to help us with our sheep, to help us with build corrals, to help us do things, because of that, you became one of us. And that's why you're invited. That's why they're not." And the Navajo have a saying, and it's called Biligana de Gis. And that's Navajo for a crazy white man. And they use that quite often. But I think, and I told our children, that I thought that it was very, very important that we went there and we wanted to become a part of them and not force them to become a part of us. And I think that was really, really critical. But let's jump back to the article. I'd like to finish this up before the program is over. But Lincoln's armies, after decimating and destroying the South in the war to prevent Southern independence, turned its war criminals loose on the Indians or of the Great Plains and the American Southwest. The tactics of murder, rape, and pillaging perfected in such places as Atlanta, the March to the Sea, and the Shenandoah Valley were repeated in places with names like Sand Creek and Wounded Knee. Small wonder one of Lincoln's favorite generals was William Tecumseh Sherman, who wrote to his wife in 1862 that his goal was the, quote, "extermination, not of soldiers alone. That is the least of the trouble, but the people of the South," unquote. Extermination of the people of the South. He said while campaigning against the American Indian, and I quote, "The only good Indian I ever saw was dead," and lamented to his son shortly before his death that he had been unable to kill all of the red sons of bitches, unquote. Abraham Lincoln's American system, adopted from Henry Clay, brought about the necessity for the removal of the Indians from the West. This concept of government had been vetoed as unconstitutional by virtually every president, beginning with our buddy, Little Jimmy Madison. The system called for the subsidizing of the railroads with stolen taxpayer money. Lincoln had long been the primary attorney representing the railroads before being elected president. For the railroads to complete their lines into the West, the Indian had to be either neutralized or eliminated. Thus, Lincoln left his fingerprints on the campaign against the Indians well into the 19th century. Lincoln's policies of taxpayer-supported railroads would lead not only to the attempted annihilation of the American Indian, but to tremendous scandals in the administration of another of Lincoln's war criminals, Ulysses Simpson Grant. Actually, his name was Hiram Ulysses. He got the U.S. because his demand for unconditional surrender. Grant, like Lincoln, handed out his political plum appointments of Indian agents to cronies who proceeded to gain tremendous wealth by selling the supplies intended for the Indians and stealing the money that should have gone to the Indians. Today, as we Southerners protest the conversion of the battlefields of the National Park Service into the beginnings of reparations for slavery by Marxist politicians and journalists, and challenge the erection of a statue of Lincoln in Richmond, Virginia, we might ask ourselves, as the Indian has done for years, why, in the most sacred land of the Oglala Sioux, is there a monument carved into a granite monument, a figure of Abraham Lincoln, who promised the annihilation of a band of the Sioux to please his political cronies? To continue to idolize Lincoln is to refute history and intellectual thought and to worship at the foot of Marxist government. Perhaps in the not-too-distant future, Americans will be able to see the Lincoln administration and its legacy of how we are governed today in the light of truth. We may even be able to see its consequences as clearly, as the Cherokee Nation saw them in 1861. Cal, your thoughts?
Well, one of the things that is pointed out is this relationship between the government and, say, like the railroads, or the government and any other business. There's a term that's been thrown around for that, and I believe it's called fascism. So we're watching the start of fascism through the Lincoln regime.
Wait, Cal. Start of fascism? I think if you will look at the lessons recently on Teach Me, you will see that fascism and the connection with business and industry started with one Alexander Hamilton.
That is true. We're seeing we're seeing the expansion of fascism, the expanding of fascism through the Lincoln regime and the radical Republicans. Would that be a more fair and accurate statement?
Yes, sir.
It was expanded under the radical Republicans.
Most certainly.
And this is that vaunted, Republican Party. This isn't conservative. They call themselves conservatives. What are they conserving? Fascism?
Yes.
That's an ideal that promotes rightful liberty?
They're conserving fascism and the domination of government over the individual.
Well, been propagandized to believe this, to worship government, which is another socialist construct, isn't it? To place government as the sovereign? To worship government? Aren't children indoctrinated every day in the government schools to worship government, to pledge to the government?
Oh, very much so. You started off, and let's not forget in the 1920s and 1930s, when the children stood up to do the Pledge of Allegiance, they gave the Nazi salute. Instead of putting their hand over their heart, they gave the Nazi salute, except they turned their palms up instead of down.
Yeah. Well, that originates from the legions back during Rome.
Right.
And that was a symbol of the legionnaire. Actually, they started with their hand over their heart and then put their hand out. In other words, that was a symbolic representation of pledging their heart to Caesar, to the government. And that's what that represented. That was taking out of their heart and giving it to Caesar. That's what that whole motion meant. And so that's, people have pledged their heart to the government. Now, all my Christian friends, I'm pretty sure you were told that's not who you're supposed to pledge your heart to. Pretty sure it wasn't government.
Well, Cal, when did all this worship of government really begin? I mean, really, really with a great emphasis.
Well, it's been ongoing. It's really accelerated, I would say, in the last 40 years. Really accelerated. I mean, back when I was a kid, my Southern friends still had that little bit of rebel spirit in them. I don't see it anymore. No offense to my, you know, those that still are true Southerns down there, but I'm not seeing that as much anymore. I'm seeing a subjugated people who worship the flag that subjugated them. And that bothers me. I don't know why, but it does.
Well, Cal, I want to do a deep dive into this at some time in the future, but I believe that most people aren't familiar with the fact that once the South was dominated by the Union Army in 1865 and then moving forward, the teachers and the preachers in the South were replaced with what we call carpetbaggers. And they came in, and one of the first things that was required every day, whether you were at school or whether you were at church, was to offer up prayers for the government. And that, when you start doing that with children, I remember the story I heard years and years ago of when Castro first came into Cuba and took over Cuba along with Che Guevara, who was really the brains behind that operation. But when they came in and they took over Cuba, Castro and Guevara would travel to the schools, especially with the young impressionable kids, and they would actually go into the classrooms and they would say, "All right, everyone, I want you to pray to God for ice cream and cake." And the kids would do so. And then when they would stand around and wait and look around, look out the windows and do all of their machinations, finally Castro or his representatives and Che Guevara, his representatives, would say to the students, "Now, pray to Castro for ice cream and cookies and cake." And the kids would. And post haste, Castro would bring in ice cream, cookies, and cake to the children. That is a lesson in indoctrination. And the radical Republicans began that in the South in 1866, 1867 with the Reconstruction Act. They began doing that. And to their credit, one of the things, and I want to do a program on this, is how the black church split in the South along those lines of the black churches who still pushed the theory of the Trinity and still pushed the theory of a worship of God above the worship of government. And how those churches ended up splitting. The black church itself ended up splitting because of this Reconstruction. That is something we never touch, Cal. I know today we've touched on the Indian situation, which most people have probably never heard of. But the Reconstruction in the South, yes, the black people revolted against Reconstruction too. But does anyone give them credit for that? No. It's just not taught. Also in the schools, the school teachers every day would start off the whole school day with not only a pledge of allegiance, but a prayer to the government. Now you think that, and we're beginning to see it now, all these 150 years later, this 10th plank of the Communist Manifesto, we're beginning to see that and beginning to reap the fruits of what has been taking place in the American education system for 150 years. So thoughts, Cal?
Well, when you bring it up, I'm always reminded of one of my favorite people who had a saying, one of my favorite people who's an example of rightful liberty in life and an example in his teachings, was a guy who said, "Suffer the children to come unto me." Because he too understood that if you teach the children this as a young person, it most likely will stick with them through most of their life. So I see the wisdom in that. I mean, Lenin followed it. The North did it to the South through Reconstruction. And I just want to point that out, that, you know, there's a great amount of wisdom in Suffer the Children to Come Unto Me. Look at the lessons that your kid learned being on the Navajo Nation. True, it doesn't stick with all of them. I mean, there's other influences, and it's a choice each individual has to make. But the opportunity to learn was there, and they, especially your son, learned from it. And I think that's wonderful. And I'm glad you shared that with everyone.
Well, it's one of those things. My son and I were talking about this earlier in the week, and he brought up how very, very special his time on the reservation is to him now as a man who is approaching middle age. But how he still reverts back to that. And then he said one of the really wonderful things for him that he very much remembers is being a captain in the U.S. Army in Iraq, 2004. And they got some new people into their unit. And he said he was just absolutely amazed to see one of his former teammates from his football team in Shiprock, New Mexico. And he said he was kind of chastised by his commanding officer for actually, this was an enlisted man, and of course my son was an officer, but he was actually chastised for actually physically hugging this guy. And my son said...
For being human, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, my son said... You
chastised
know,
for being human.
Yeah, they could criticize me all they wanted to, but he said, I hadn't seen this guy in, you know, going on... you know, almost 15 years. And he said, I'm sure a lot of people didn't understand. You know, he said, I even had some people ask me, Captain, how do you know that Indian?
That'd be a story. Yeah, I went to school with him. It's not he went to school with me, I went to school with him type thing, you know. But your son was the minority, yeah. And that's a great lesson. I mean, you know, physically to be in those shoes, to know what it's really like to be a minority, to know what it's like to be subjugated, to know what it's like to be segregated. I mean, unless you've actually had it done to you, you really don't know what it's like. And you don't know what kind of a humiliating or intimidating or just, I don't know, cringing against justice that feeling is.
Cal, have you ever heard of a ceremony called by the American Indians, several different tribes have it, called the Enemy Way?
No, I haven't.
They would have a special ceremony for their warriors before they entered combat. And my son thought it was especially, it meant so much to him. And he mentioned this to me a couple of days ago. We were talking on the phone. He said he will never forget that several Navajos got on a plane in 2001, got on a plane for the first time in their lives and flew out to Virginia to watch him graduate from Virginia Military Institute. And he was just overwhelmed that they showed up, that they thought so much of him that they would come to his college graduation ceremony. But then about 3 years later, when he was had been given his deployment to Iraq in about September, October 2004, if I remember correctly, the people on the Navajo found out about it through various connections, I'm sure. And we were invited, my wife Susanna and I were invited to go to Shiprock, New Mexico and to participate in a Enemy Way, is what they referred to their ceremony. to participate in an enemy way ceremony as representative for our son who was about to go into combat. Now, a lot of people may say, well, yeah, well, so what? Man, I tell you what, that is one memory that hangs in my closet that will never be forgotten. And it meant so very much that the people remembered us and remembered him to the point that we were invited to come all the way back to northern New Mexico to participate in that ceremony, which was being done specifically for our son. That is, money can't buy that, buddy.
No, that's an amazing story. That's to be included in a Navajo tradition like that as an outsider, so to speak, that you've been accepted in, but that's quite an honor. But that just for the testament of the type of character that you are, just, to be included in that. And that's just by being you, who you are. And that's just a wonderful story. Thanks, Mike.
Well, I appreciate that. And I also wrote an article about the Navajo cattle drive, which will be on my rebelmadman.org before too much longer. I wrote an article back, 2007, 2008, somewhere in there, maybe before that, that was published in the Navajo Times, which is the newspaper of the Navajo people. And that article was published, pardon me, that article was published in the Navajo Times, and I have put a reprint of it on my website. And also, I'll never forget, I think it was in 2005 or 2006, I wrote an article that was published at lewrockwell.com, and the title of my article was Indians Should Know Better. And I got an email from the chief of the Blackfoot tribe a few days after that was published, and he asked me for permission to reprint that article in the newspaper of the Blackfoot Indian. And of course, I said, I'm honored. I appreciate you doing that. So, yeah, Cal, as we move on through life, these things that you and I both know this. Young people haven't figured it out yet. My son is beginning to. But of the things that you're able to collect, you might collect property, you might collect wealth, you might collect a lot of things. But the things that really matter are those memories. And those are the ones that I hold near and dear.
Exactly.
And I hope I haven't bored you and the listening audience to death with those.
Well, you haven't bored me at all. I hope the listening audience, if they're bored, that's on them. And these stories are wonderful. I'm glad you're sharing them. This is part of that I cherish other people's experiences that I was speaking of earlier. I just find it wonderful. This is part of the humanity and brotherhood of man. This is the way it's supposed to go, people. Not this, he gave this guy he hadn't seen for forever a hug. Well, you can't do that because you're an officer and he's an enlisted man. Well, I'm sorry, humanity took over.
Yeah.
Imagine that. If humanity instead of politics took over. You want a solution, folks? Reach into your humanity. Cling to your rightful liberty. Know where it came from and defend it. Secure it, defend it, and properly exercise it. I know I keep saying it, it hasn't caught on, but it's my contention that freedom, people's freedom, true rightful freedom, comes from the securing of and proper exercise of rightful liberty. People say there's a price that freedom isn't free. Well, that's the price, the securing and exercise of rightful liberty. That's the price of it. Doesn't involve some mercenary going off into some foreign land, killing somebody we don't even know. Which is exactly opposite of liberty. It comes from securing rightful liberty and properly exercising it. But that's the guiding point in my life. And, you know, I look to Jesus of Nazareth as one of the greatest examples of how that rightful liberty or free will, if you want to call it, is properly exercised, his mentality. People say, what would Jesus do? And I always go, well, yeah, but what didn't Jesus do? I don't remember him forcing anybody to do anything other than kicking the banksters out of the temple. That's the only time I see him using any type of force. So there's a lesson in that, too, at least one for me.
Well, Cal, you know, we've kind of jumped ship on the subject here, and I like it. But here's the thing.
But it all relates back, Mike. It all does. It's just tying history back together. I'm taking a broader picture because I've looked at it for a little longer than other people. I'm able to put those dots and connect dots and make this picture of the reality I see, which is a pursuit of rightful liberty. And all I'm doing is sharing that with others so that they too might be able to see it, because they have to do it for themselves, because rightful liberty is individual. Each individual has to do it for themselves. I can't do it for you, and no one else can either.
Well, Cal, you bring something up, and I'm going to have to ask you this question, and this is totally off base for our subject today. But the part of the Bible says, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar and to God that which is God. Do you see that as a mandate to pay taxes?
No. No, because that's a fruit of my labor. I earned that. That's not the government. The government didn't earn it. It's not the government's. If they want, you know, I mean, yeah, we exchange in they're not even government notes. They're the Federal Reserve notes. It's not even the government. But it still represents the fruits of my labor. So, no, I don't see giving unto Caesar that which is Caesar is equivalent to paying taxes.
Well, Cal, who was Caesar at that time?
Augustus Caesar. Augustus.
Tiberius Caesar.
Was it Tiberius at that time? I thought it was still Augustus.
And Tiberius Caesar was a pedophile, a... murdered people. He did a lot of things. And I think that, you know, if you really get into that scripture, and we're, you know, we got a few minutes left here. But if you really get into that scripture, you will see that why did Jesus ask the people who were questioning him? Why did he ask them for the coin?
Because it was a special coin from Caesar, so it actually was Caesar's property.
Well, it had his picture.
So if you want to take this, well, it had a certain connotation to it also that meant that this was a Roman thing. This was of Caesar. It wasn't Jesus' coin in the first place. It wasn't his coin, so yeah, give it to Caesar, which is Caesar's. But render unto God all that which is God's, which is... Well, if God's the creator of everything, that means you would render everything back to God, wouldn't you? Especially your liberty. You wouldn't render it to Caesar. You would render it to God. How many render their liberty to the government voluntarily?
Oh, almost all of them. Look what they're doing with these stupid-ass mandates right now. Well, Cal, let's talk about something. What subject would you like to approach next week?
I'm open for anything. I enjoy going down these rabbit holes, Mike.
Well, I'm going to dump this in your lap. What do you want?
Well, let's wait till after you've got Sunday's program with DW. You guys are going into the Bundy thing, right?
No, we're doing that tomorrow on Scorpio's
show. Tomorrow. Okay. I knew it was coming up. And
yeah.
I don't know. Let's go through that, and maybe we'll expand upon that a bit.
Well, Sunday, DW and I are going into the question, why does the United States government have an agency in place to enforce each one of the planks of the Communist Manifesto?
Because we... has been, basically the Constitution has been a somewhat communist document from the get-go anyway.
Yeah.
It's just further exercise of the Constitution. That's why.
Well, it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun to get into that because how many people know that there is a government alphabet agency, at least one, in place to enforce all 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto? How many people know that?
Let's put it this way. Because communism is about control of the people, and this government is about control of the people. So it only makes sense that even if there wasn't the communist planks, they would still have these agencies in place.
Exactly. Well, let me jump in here. We're running out of time. Let me jump in here and tell folks that they can find my website, rebelmadman.org. I'm moving my articles to there, about 25 years worth of articles. It's going to take me a while. Rebelmadman.com will eventually be used as a show notes page where I will post, the sources of the things we quote on the show. And then I have a brand new Telegram site at Teach Me True History. And I also still have Rebel Madman and Constitutional Fraud on the Telegram stations. So, and of course, Cal, you've been with me for a long time on Facebook Messenger, on my group, which is simply titled Teach Me. So, we got about a minute. Tell the people what you have been able to gather from that Teach Me site, if you can put it in a minute.
I've been able to gather true history from that Teach Me site. Mike provides a lot of the source documents and his queries and questions and lessons, at least for me, lead me down further rabbit holes and further studies. And from that, I just gained further understandings of history so that I can understand history so I can place myself in the present and plan for the future.
Well, thanks, Cal. I appreciate that.
The thing of it is, this is more than any type of history you could ever pay at any government institution to learn. And I would just encourage anybody to make themselves available of everything you've put out on any of your sites.
Thanks,
and try
Cal.
And prove Mike wrong. Try and prove him wrong if you want.
Oh, I enjoy that. Well, there's the music, guys. Hey, folks, thank you so much for tuning in. And, come back tomorrow or tomorrow at 2:00 and listen to us on Scorpio Show and next week on Dare to Think Out Loud. Thanks, Cal. Appreciate you, my friend.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Zero 0 XE 0 5 1 7 3.
We talk about decentralization and fact.